How's it going, baseball fans? Welcome back to another edition of the Roster Rhetorical, episode number 41. As always, Chris Schubert, Matt Goldman here with you. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt because Matt is going to introduce our special guest this week that is going to be hanging out with us for this episode.
Yes, and for a change, our special guest is not Chris Cotillo. We're switching it up
a little bit. He normally is our guest.
He is. So instead, I would like to introduce Eno Saris, who is obviously a frequent contributor to FanGraphs. You'll see his stuff on ESPN and a bunch of other sites from time to time. And I believe we can now say or introduce you as a published author. Is that correct?
Well, I self-published an ebook, so
that still counts.
It's the shallow end.
In today's world, if you can publish something on the internet, it counts. So,
right. So I've been published for a while.
Yeah, I think we can put that in the checkbox.
I think that's how you need to start getting introduced at, you know, pitch talks and all these other places. The esteemed author, Eno Saris.
Yeah, esteemed author of a beer book.
Yeah.
Hey, people love beer. I think it works. Eno, thanks for hanging out with us for a little bit today. Matt, I'll start if that's all right with you.
Of course.
So I'll be honest, you're a beer fan, and I think Matt can remember this, that on the show I have discussed that I am not the biggest beer drinker in the world, but I was excited to have you on because on your Twitter the other day I saw that you had a picture. It was a FedEx box that had beer in it. Is this true?
That is true, yeah.
I didn't know that beer could be delivered in a FedEx box.
Well, it's mostly trading. So it's kind of fun. It makes me feel a little bit like I'm doing a fantasy trade or a baseball card trade, and you just have to get in touch with somebody from somewhere else. And so I got in touch with somebody. We do these beer chats on Beer Graphs on Fridays, and I got in touch with somebody. I think that box was from St. Louis.
Are there ever beers to be named later in these deals?
There are. They're called throw-ins.
Okay.
You might recognize that language. They're actually a lot of fun. People just throw in an extra one when they're packing it all up, and you get a little surprise on your end. That one was a great trade. It was full of Side Project and Schlafly and Urban Chestnut, which are, you know, brewers that don't have any distribution out here on the West Coast. So I got to try some of St. Louis without having to go there. It's fairly quick. It's about a week. It's a little expensive. It adds maybe, you know, $2 to $3 per beer, but beer nerds are very used to spending money on their beers. So that's, $2 to $3 on top of whatever you were going to spend anyway. And you get to try, it's almost like, you know, flying to St. Louis and trying some of the best beer.
Now, for your book, I just want to make sure that I'm getting this right. It's called A Baseball Lover's Guide to Craft Beer. So, if you had to pick which baseball stadium that you've been to, I don't know how many you've knocked down off your list, but what's your favorite baseball stadium to get a nice beer?
Well, I haven't been to Seattle yet. And Seattle would be my number one ranking just from gathering information. And, you know, for this book, we went and talked to the different beat writers and beer bloggers and, you know, people on Twitter, and just tried to get a high end recommendation on a lot of different places in each media market. And so we went to each baseball market and we talked to a bunch of the writers, a bunch of the bloggers, and just put together a recommendation list, used some of Beer Graph's leaderboards. We have leaderboards for beers, and just made leaderboards for the stadiums and made leaderboards for the cities around them, and tried to basically create little crawls where you could go to this museum and there's a craft beer bar in the museum, and when you turn the corner, best pizza in town, and right down the block is this brewery, and then, you know, two more blocks down is the ballpark. That sort of stuff we tried to put together. So if you're talking like the whole experience, I think Seattle might be up there. I really enjoyed visiting Seattle, and I know they have a great park. But if you're just talking park, I think it's really hard to beat San Diego. San Diego has some of the best beer, you know, in the neighborhood, and they've done a really good job of bringing that into the stadium. So San Diego's amazing that way.
I've heard, and Matt, I think you can attribute to this, that one of our own writers, Mike Bates, was talking the other day in our offices about different places where he's enjoyed beer. And he went down to Miami for, I think, a Sabre conference and stuff like that. And he said that out of all of the experiences that he's had, minor league parks seemingly have the best beer for him. That his number one was a minor league park. I forgot. I think it was Cedar Rapids was the one that he mentioned. So, you know, do you feel that in your experience that certain big league parks may not live up to the standards that some minor league parks have with beer?
And actually that ties into this whole – I think he's probably right. I haven't been to a ton of minor league parks, but on the sum, I would agree. And more than anecdotally, it lines up with this sort of theory of marketing that I've been putting together, which is that the minor league teams you see every once in a while, they make a real big gaffe and they just do a real stupid night where they say something stupid and then everyone's like, oh, that sucks, this and this and that and whatever. They do have big misses. But minor league parks, in order to get people into minor league parks, you have to be really good at marketing. You have to be really good at coming up with things other than baseball to get them to the park. Just because the baseball itself is not – they're not full of players that they care about. They're not the same players year in and year out, and it's not the pros. So you kind of have to do a whole experience thing, and you have to say, oh, tonight this famous chef is coming and doing his craziest hot dogs, or tonight is going to be like a crazy karate demonstration before the game, or you know, whatever. Basically, in the big leagues, all you get are bobbleheads and fireworks.
What about churro dogs? The Diamondbacks have a churro dog.
There you go.
I think counts.
The teams that are worse, and this is part of my theory, is that the teams that are worse in the major leagues or have had worse times in their lives have done better jobs at creating stadium experiences that matter, that can bring people in even when the team is bad. So San Diego's been bad forever, and Seattle's been bad, and they have really good beer experiences, and they've made sure to bring in local beers, which is an effort because when you're a big stadium, it's really hard to staff, like to have like a brewer, like a beer bar where there's actually beers moving through it at a high velocity. What you want to do as a big stadium is say, we got to deal with Anheuser InBev. We've got Budweiser, stamp it, finish, done, you know? So Yankee Stadium, on the other hand, has had people in there forever and they don't care. And people will come when they're bad, and for the most part, their beer is probably bottom three beer stadium in America.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, but looking back on it, I've moved out here to Austin, so I've been up to Round Rock a few times now, once to go see Hunter Pence play for 2 innings until he got hurt. So that was kind of unfortunate. But, you know, they do have a huge beer selection there. They've got something like they've got this one stand that might have over 30 different selections, which, you know, when you're going to a normal game and you're expecting to have choices between Budweiser, Bud Light and Bud Light Lime, seeing more than 20 options is a pretty welcome sight. And I was actually just looking at the beer graphs rankings or the leaderboards at a glance and noticed that Pliny the Elder is third. So I guess I have to thank you for introducing me to the third best beer, according to you guys.
Yeah, that's in my own personal rankings, it's a little bit lower. And so it's been something that I send to people because it brings me more back in trade than I necessarily would get from it in my own fridge.
All right, so you're putting a little your own depth rankings there, so you can part with stuff that you don't really have a high value in.
Yeah,
you know, just explain for maybe somebody like me who doesn't fully get it because I'm not a beer guy, but break down how the leaderboards work, how the rankings are compiled, just to give us a little bit of idea of how it all works.
We have a deal with a. We have a deal with an API, basically. So we get the data from a company called Untappd, which is just it's a social networking and beer tagging, sort of beer collecting network that people will basically check in and say, I'm drinking this beer. I give it 5 stars. And they can see which beers they've had and see what other people have thought of beers and stuff like that. And we've taken their data and we've basically sliced it a little bit differently than them, tried to compare beers only within style before comparing it to the general population, create a replacement level that we've messed around with that's sort of a different replacement level per style and all this stuff. We've just basically you know, played around with the numbers a little bit and created leaderboards that you can sort for region, for style, for alcohol by content, created a couple of new stats that sort of give you an idea of the general quality of a brewery and a beer. So it's a lot of fun. And if your listeners, actually, if they're interested in this book, it's basically like these a beer guide to baseball cities is another way of putting it. It's at beergraphs.com book. So beergraphs.com/book. And listeners here will get $1 off if they use the code BG-WeLoveYou. So that's BG-WeLoveYou. So,
see, guys, we just bring you all the good stuff here on the show. So, you know, let's talk a little baseball. I know we wanted to talk beer for a little bit, but I want to switch gears. And before I ask this question, because it's sort of it's a long one. How many times do you have somebody email you, tweet at you, or any sort of way get in contact with you about an article that you've written like 2 or 3 years ago and they just hammer you for it? Is that something that happens a lot for you?
You know, I know that it happens all the time, Dave Cameron, and I feel badly for him, but you know, we're very different writers. So, you know, he's a little bit more where he will take a stance on something and give it like sort of trade transaction analysis. And I do some of that, but because him and Jeff Sullivan are so good and now we have August, I can kind of do my own thing. And my own thing is a little bit more maybe like researchy and a lot of player interviews. So it's kind of hard for me to like do a player interview with someone and be like, this player sucks. Listen to all the things he said. He's totally wrong. He sucks. So I'm a little bit more trying to find little quirks that players have done that have made them better. And maybe sometimes I'll do survey pieces where I bring together different things and be like, this looks like it's effective for this kind of player. And this looks like it's effective for other kinds of players. But rarely am I like, you know, and I did do this one time. I'll give everybody the food for their rage machine. I wrote that the Indians should consider trading Francisco Lindor because Jose Ramirez looked very good at shortstop.
We've all got those.
Yeah, though everybody has those in their career when they've written something and they're just like, you might want to go back and fix that. Well,
I wish I could delete that one.
So you said that, and the article that I am going to reference is not one of those articles where you have quotes or you're sort of discussing a certain player, and it's a team that is near and dear to my heart. It is the New York Mets, but I don't know how much of what you've written in the past you can remember offhand, but in November after the World Series, you wrote a piece about them and you said, can the Mets get back? And I read this piece and this was at a time when I was really distraught. I thought, oh, there's no way they're going to get back. It's impossible. They blew their chance. And I read your article and I was like, okay, this is the guide map to getting this team back to the World Series and having them be a contender again. And the part that stuck out to me was at the end where you said, a medium price free agent, some relievers, and growth and good health from the young players, and they're right back in it. They're a team that could be competitive. Now, when you wrote that, did you expect them to get Cespedes and Neil Walker, not get many relievers, and have all their growth and health go out the window and then be where they are right now? That's really what I want to get to the bottom of, is that did you foresee this happening to this team?
I didn't. I mean, I think it was very hard for anyone to foresee that Cespedes deal. Just it. I know that there are more and more teams giving opt outs, but you know, a player of his stature in the past just got 5 years guaranteed and $100 million plus, and you know, thank you very much. This is my big contract. He was willing to sort of put it on the line a little bit, and they were willing to give him that option because it seems front offices everywhere want to give that option now and just get a couple years of a player on a rental deal and then say, thank you, we paid market price, but we're not locked into you when you're 35. So I think, you know, that's what happened a little bit with Cespedes. And that, of course, I think probably threw them off the other ways because, you know, if you don't get Cespedes, then you have the money to maybe go after Zobrist. And they were in on Zobrist. If you have the money to maybe spread it around a little bit. But after you spend all that money on Cespedes, I think everything changes after that. So, you know, I think the trade for Walker was great. You know, signing Cespedes to that deal, I could get behind. I think that some of the trades we've seen and some of the work they've had to do since to make the bullpen a little bit better, you know, I think shows that they probably should have spent a little bit more attention on the bullpen.
Keeping with the Mets,
This is not one of my worst pieces, I don't think.
Well, it gave me confidence, if that makes you feel any better. I was excited for the offseason, so.
Yeah, it was a weird offseason, so, you know, it wasn't so bad to be excited for it. It was, no. Yeah.
Actually, you know, mentioned something. I guess it was a couple things. One, Chris saying how this article made him feel better, at least at the time. That's exactly how I felt reading your piece about Matt Moore. It was pretty rough to see Duffy headed off. I wasn't prepared for that. But then reading your article about Matt Moore's stuff, how it's back, that calmed me down quite a bit. But in keeping with the Mets, this is not a statsy question at all. Do you think David Wright will ever play third base again for the Mets?
No. I mean, it's the saddest thing in the world, but...
Eno, you're not instilling confidence anymore.
No, I know. To me, David Wright is one of those guys I can put on a pantheon. It's an interesting place I'll put him, but like Chipper Jones and Barry Bonds and David Wright, to me, the grouping is something good's going to happen. You know, it's not it's hard to say that those three all together, the best hitters forever. I do think Barry Bonds is the best hitter ever, but, you know, the three of them as a group aren't necessarily the best hitters ever, but they were, and I don't want to put clutch in there. It's just that they were so good at just at least taking a walk if they weren't going to hit the ball. You know what I mean? And just the combination of the power threat, you know, plus the ability to take a walk, the good discipline, you know, in their peaks, all three of those guys gave a lot of value defensively and even on the base path. So really, I know they're not, you know, five tool players like in the way that Mike Trout is, but those three are in my sort of, in a way, I guess, a five tool pantheon, or just, you know, guys I want in my lineup in a game I have to win. So I feel really badly about it, but the thing that he's got, the stenosis, is just going to get worse and worse. And I mean, maybe he plays one more game, maybe he plays a little bit more, but you know, whatever, what just happened, that's going to happen again. It's going to be worse next time. So, you know, at some point I think someone's going to tell him not to play and we're going to have a press conference. It's going to be very sad.
Yeah, it's a rough way for a career like that to come to an end. It, you know, really just not on his terms at all. But as this might be the cheesiest segue we've ever done, but as one...
We do a lot of cheesy segues, Matt.
As one career ends, another begins. That's pretty cheesy, right? What's up with Alex Bregman? Obviously, you know, he put up ridiculous numbers in the minor leagues, and I don't think anyone was expecting him to hit like Mike Trout when he got to the big leagues, but he's got a slash line of 125, 192, 167, and his current WRC plus before playing tonight is -5. I don't think anyone would have predicted he'd struggle this much. Is it looking like he's just completely overmatched at the major league level and he needs more time in AAA, or is he just running into some horrible luck?
You know, there's a weird dance that happens at the beginning. And I think what happens is, like, when you first get up, you have to prove to the pitchers that you can hit before they start treating you like a hitter. And, you know, so I think that shows up in things like swing rate and reach rate and stuff. He might have a real great innate sense of where the strike zone is. That seems to be, you know, the story of his minor league stats, where he didn't strike out much and he walked a fair amount. You know, everything that was in play looked like it was hard. So, you know, that sort of thing happened in the minor leagues, but in order to do it again up here, he has to, you know, prove that they can't just fill up the zone on him, basically. And, you know, he's not reaching a lot. And reach rate is, you know, interesting because it's over the denominator's pitches instead of plate appearances. So even though he's only had 52 plate appearances, he has seen 204 pitches. He reaches less often than other people. So I think he knows what the strike zone is. I think that pitchers don't respect his power right now, and they just basically are filling up the zone. If you look at his zone percentage, it's higher than league average. So, right around league average. Actually, it's exactly league average. It's sort of weird. But anyway, there's a sort of give and take that happens with any young guy that comes up. He has to prove, even Joey Votto has to prove that he can hit the inside pitch because pitchers want to crowd him. and they crowd him and they crowd him, and he has to hit the inside pitch before they go somewhere else where he'd rather they go. So in that sense, like what we're seeing with Bregman is probably they have some sort of book on him and they're filling up the zone and they're doing it in certain places that he doesn't like. And he has to prove that he can hit it or, you know, they're not going to leave that space. And this doesn't mean that he can't do it. It just means that right now he's not doing it and he hasn't – whatever they're doing, they're just going to keep doing it until he finds something, you know, to do against it. Which I – this is what I love about baseball is these adjustments that these players make. It's almost virtually impossible to know who's going to be able to make the adjustment ahead of time. But a guy with his track record, I'd say that he'll make the adjustment. It just may not happen in his first year. It may take until the second year.
Well, isn't that a conversation that we sort of have with all these rookies when they come up and we sort of just see which ones adjust better? Like the Mike Trouts and the Bryce Harpers of the world adjust better than, let's say, the Bregmans are so far, the Michael Confortos, guys like that. Is it just something as simple as recognizing pitches better at the big league level, seeing different speeds, different movement, or is it just more mental that they have to just get into this mindset of, okay, this is what they're going to do, now I have to adjust?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's mental. I mean, they see fairly good pitchers. I mean, he might be beating up on bad pitchers in the minor leagues, but with numbers like that, there's probably some hits off of good pitchers. And I think what you're seeing at the major league level is him not understanding what they're trying to do to him and not knowing what to do about it, basically. Because I talked to Clint Frazier, and Clint Frazier, the guy who just got traded to the Yankees for Andrew Miller, he's a great hitter, and he has a lot of power, and he's toolsy, but he's had a strikeout problem. Every year his strikeout's gotten better, and I've talked to him maybe three or four times over the last 3 years. And each time I ask him about it, and he said, and I say, "Well, are you seeing curves better? What's going on? Are you seeing this? Are you seeing that?" And he said, "No, I just have a better sense of what they're trying to do to me." And you know, I think Bregman comes up, and you bet on a guy with his statistical profile 9 times out of 10. I mean, here's a guy who doesn't strike out a lot, who does walk, who hits for power, and has, you know, running speed, and, you know, is athletic in terms of body, and is a high-ranked prospect. That's the guy you bet on every single time. And the fact that it's not working out just tells you how incredibly difficult baseball is, I think.
Matt, you put your hand up. He just puts his hand up. He wants to ask a question, and now I can't hear him.
No, I can't hear him either. Maybe he has his mute.
Is it Braille?
Ah.
Oh, he says his mic got cut. Okay, this has got to stay in the podcast now because he yells at me all the time when things go haywire. So I'm going to keep this in until he comes back. All right, so while we wait for Matt to get back, because it looked like he had a question, you know, I'm going to bring a very random. This is when Matt talks about cheesy segues, this is a terrible segue. Uh-huh. But I'm going to bring this in because it's sort of part of the news of the day, and I just want to get your thoughts on this as a baseball expert, I think is a fair way we can describe you. The news of the day that I think it's Lourdes, and Matt and I were discussing this earlier. Do you know how he pronounces his name?
No.
Lourdes Gurriel Jr.? Does that sound right to you?
I'm like literally the last person in the world to ask.
Okay.
Because I'm German and Jamaican, and I use every wrong culture to approach someone's name and say things that are supposed to be one language and another. I would have said more like French, like Lourdes, but Lourdes.
Oh, Lourdes. Okay, but that was not one of the options that me and Matt had said earlier.
But doesn't Baseball Reference tell us how to say it?
You know what? That was the first place Matt and I looked, and it doesn't.
Oh, boy.
It does not give us any background. So, all right. So,
well, we can call him Junior. I mean,
we're going to call him
the better Gurriel.
Maybe. Yeah. So we're going to go Gurriel Jr.
Uh-huh.
And he is now a free agent, according to Eric Longerhagen. And his brother, Uleski, signed a deal with the Astros about a month ago now. And now with him being a free agent, he's still suspect to the international free agency until he turns 23. He's 22 right now. He turns 23, I believe, in October. So, you know, I just wanted to get your thoughts on what you think the market for him is going to be. Does his brother play any sort of impact in where he goes? And what kind of player are we looking at here?
Well, the younger one, I think, the older one is like 32.
Yes, he's 32.
32. The younger one's much younger, and he's going to be more of a project and more of a, you know, a thing that you're looking for in the future. His best year so far in Cuba, he hit .298 with a .390 slugging percentage. So it looks like, and a .385 OPP. So it looks like he might be able to, you know, discern the strike zone well. But the slugging is what, you know, you're kind of waiting on. And so I think the market will be a little bit different than his brother, where his brother is, you know, high floor, low ceiling. The younger brother is you know, much more about ceiling and less floor. So I think that you'll see different kinds of teams. We know that probably the Padres, you know, I guess the Padres would still be in because they still have a little bit of this is the year they're blowing it out, right?
With their international cap, right?
Yeah, they're blowing. So, you know, you have a choice with the way the international cap works now to sort of, you know, basically pick 1 year and go nuts in it and then take 2 years off. And so this is the year for the Padres. So you have to guess they would be in if he counts against this year's cap. And then, you know, another team that's spent a lot this offseason have been the Braves. And they were, you know, those two teams and the Mets were rumored in on the older brother. So, but different kinds of markets, though, because, you know, the older brother is going to step in and play some pro ball this year, and the younger brother you have to wait for a few years. So I would say probably a team like the Padres or Braves, they're probably negotiating against each other on this one.
All right, guys. So we're back. We had a little bit of a technical issue. I'm sure you heard me say that Matt lost his microphone, and Matt almost ruined the whole show because Matt's audio we almost lost his entire audio. But we're good. We're back. Matt is here, right? Matt, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay, so you are here. So, all right. So just to finish where we left off, we were talking about Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who we're now just referring to Gurriel Jr. because we don't know how to pronounce his first name. And Eno was talking about how the Padres were one of the teams that could be interested in him because that they're going for it with all of their cap space, with their international free agency money. And I just want to finish this topic with one question, and then I think Matt has something, and then we'll wrap this up. You know, do you think a lot of teams are going to wait for him to turn 23 in order to not have to worry about using that money bonus and instead of being able to use their salary cap because he's only going to turn 23? And if, let's say, he was going to turn 28 or 29, they may want to get that extra year out of him. But because he's turning 23, they can wait a couple of months and then get him on a better deal that doesn't tap into their international money?
Well, it's going to be hard to ask a baseball team to keep it in the pants. And so I think that it'll be a real interesting question for their agent because their agent will get, you know, word of mouth sort of promises for what can happen when he turns 23. And then he'll have to compare that to, you know, what's actually been offered and what's on the table. And before you think, oh, well, like a team is going to go by its word, they don't want to burn players. You know, that's what the Red Sox just got busted for. Is, you know, verbal commitments. And a lot of those verbal commitments get broken. And so, you know, I think if I were the agent, it's the whole bird in hand versus two in the bush. You'd have to really think about, you know, how much, you know, I want to put this guy on the line. Because if it does come around to, you know, when he turns 23, you do open up who's going to talk to you. So I think that's probably what ends up happening. But if the Padres don't care about, you know, blowing out their budget, maybe they'll push the number that they, you know, so far that the agency will say, well, we didn't expect that good of a number this early. So maybe we should take it. So I don't know. I think you might be right that it will go to when he turns 23. So then everybody can talk to him. But it'll be interesting to see if anybody sort of gives him that offer he can't refuse ahead of time.
All right, Matt, go ahead. Ask your question since you ruined the whole show anyway.
Well, Chris is also not happy with the question that I'm going
to ask. Oh, I forgot. It's this question. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
You weren't even upset about that. So, okay. So, as a Giants fan, I have to ask this. Is there any glimmer of hope that Tim Lincecum could somehow become even a sort of valuable pitcher, whether that's in the bullpen? I mean, there's really nothing left for him in the rotation. So I think if there even is a glimmer of hope, it would have to come out of the bullpen there. But from what you've seen
from his comeback, is there anything that you could point to that would make you at least maybe a little bit positive about his potential future career?
Well, he's still getting whiffs, and he still has a couple of pitches that will get whiffs. I mean, basically the curve is probably around an average pitch, and then the splitter is still, you know, I'd say above average to plus pitch. The problem is that he's got minus command, minus velocity, you know, minus health at this point. So you've got a bunch of minuses stacked up against that. And for what it's worth, like when he did go to the bullpen, he didn't see much of a boost in terms of velocity. I mean, if he approached a full year as a reliever and, you know, could bump it up to 92, you know, he was 91, 92 in 2010 and 2011. He was amazing. In one of those years, actually, both of those years is pretty good. So
yeah, he was really good in 2010. He had that one blip in August, and then 2011 he was sort of back to normal.
Yeah, but then when he dropped down to 90, basically is when he, like, you know, wasn't the same anymore. So he'd have to get two ticks, and the only way you get that is from training all off season. So I don't think it would happen now. And basically, you'd have to spend all off season training to be a reliever. And, you know, it's not like he's been bad athletically in the past. I'm always amazed when I see his shirt off, how cut he is. But, you know, I think he's getting the most out of his frame that he can. So I doubt that he's going to get a jump of more than one or two ticks. And then if he's still sub 90 with bad command, he's just never going to get into good counts to throw that split finger. So, another one that I think is, sad. We just have to remember how awesome he was when he was awesome. It's just too bad it fell apart so quickly.
Yeah, he never really had that prolonged peak. It was just a 2007 got called up, and then all of a sudden 2008 he was the guy in the National League, yeah. And same in 2009, and then just after 2011, just it's been really hard to watch.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes that to get you really depressed. I wonder sometimes how much I see in common with Jeff Samardzija, because, you know, maybe Jeff Samardzija has slightly better command, but Jeff Samardzija's best foot forward is not command. And, you know, it used to be a comp that worked a lot better when Samardzija was getting a ton of strikeouts off his split finger. Now he doesn't throw the split finger as much, but you could see the velocity dropping off for Samardzija and him going to the split finger more often and then looking a lot like Tim Lincecum. And I'm not sure late career Tim Lincecum is a look that Jeff Samardzija wants.
No, I don't think anyone wants that. I've always wondered if what Lincecum's career might have looked like if he hadn't wasted all of those bullets in college. Obviously, he didn't get drafted high enough out of high school to really entertain that thought, but just wonder if he could have spent those throws in college and briefly in the minor leagues.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, we think of, for the most part, we think of guys' elbows and shoulders going. And in that way, he was mostly healthy. And yet, the action, the repetitive action of pitching takes it out of you no matter what you do. I was talking to Darren O'Day, and he throws a submarine. And that's, you know, some people think it's healthier for your arm or whatever. And he sort of agreed. But he said that in order to throw his submarine style, he has to drive his front foot into the ground and basically throw over the top of his front hip. And he said he had hip labrum surgery. He had labrum surgery for his hip. And I think that's the same thing that happened to Lincecum. he basically was driving that weird delivery he had that gave him his velocity and made him who he was also robbing from him by forcing him into this sort of stretched out position, repeatedly landing on that hip in some way that, you know, created an ongoing injury. And basically ever since the hip thing started coming up, that's when he's lost velocity and not been as good. So it's like the same delivery that gave it, you know, take it away. It's the same deal with Darren O'Day and his labrum surgeries. So, you know, I think just being athletic and doing the same movements over and over again will lead to injury. And that's one part of the pitching injury problem that people don't think about as often. I mean, yes, they talk about, you know, too many pitches, but it's really about, you know, repeating those in a certain way.
All right, Matt, anything else that you want to ask here before we get out of town?
No, I got my Lincecum reference.
Yeah, that's it. He's, you know, Matt gets a Tin Lincecum reference, story, something into every episode of the show.
So, nice. So everyone's all up to date on Tin Lincecum.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because our listeners are good to go.
Yeah, so he brings that to every episode. So I knew he was going to fit it in somewhere, and then I realized what he was going to do.
Yeah.
So, all right, so let me – I'll wrap this up, and then we'll get everybody out of here. You can follow Eno at Eno Saris, right? I got that right?
Mm-hmm. Enosarris.
Follow him on Twitter. He will give you all of these same thoughts there, along with more talk about beer, which is great for everybody. You can follow Matt at The Original Bull. You can follow me at Chris R. Schubert. If you've listened to this show a number of times, you know how I close the show. You can listen to it in a various of different ways. Through iTunes, you just search The Roster Rhetorical, and it pops up. You can subscribe. You'll get it downloaded instantly when the episodes come out. If you are not a iPhone user or you just don't like iTunes, any podcasting app will do the same thing. Just search The Roster Rhetorical or MLB Daily Dish and it will come up. If you don't like any of those options and you are someone who likes to watch the show at work or at a desktop computer, if you go to Blog Talk Radio and search The Roster Rhetorical, all the episodes are there, or at the bottom of any article at MLBDailyDish.com. There's a player there that has all the episodes with the latest episode right there at the beginning of the player. All right, that spiel is over. Eno, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and day to talk with baseball and beer with us for a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love talking baseball. Bug me anytime. My chats on Thursdays are a lot of fun. A lot of just beer and baseball and silliness and music. And so if you haven't been to a chat on Thursday, head on over to Fangraphs Thursday at noon. That's a lot of fun.
Matt, you should ask your Tim Lincecum questions there.
Well, you know, I actually did jump into – I want to say it was probably 2 weeks ago. I came in with some stupid name. I can't remember what it was. I always like to disguise myself in case things go badly. But I asked you if Adalberto Mejia was ready to, you know, step in and at least give the rotation a shot since Kane and Peavy weren't doing anything. And you you gave me a quick hit. You said that, you know, he's learned a touch on his changeup and it's really become a good go-to pitch for him. So I was all excited after that chat to see him at the big league level. And then I guess I'll have to go watch that elsewhere now.
Yeah. Somewhere else. He was useful though. He was useful to the Giants. So
this is true.
So, all right, guys, thanks for hanging out with us this week and we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.